This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, this is The Money. I'm Richard Aidy. Russian troops are still massed on Ukraine's borders, and Moscow has been threatened with the mother of all sanctions if they invade. But how effective is that threat? Actually, how effective are sanctions? We'll get to that a bit later. Let's start with the RBA. The governor, Philip Lowe, gave an important speech the other day. If you watch 7:30, you might have seen the finance journalist Alan Kohler talk about how uncertainty was a theme of that speech and what the RBA does not know. One thing we certainly don't know is when interest rates are going up. The market believes there'll be 3, maybe 4 rate rises this year. Philip Lowe says it's plausible that there won't be a rise for another 12 months. Sarah Hunter is a senior economist and partner at KPMG. Sarah, who's right?
Excellent question. And I think another buzzword from the governor's speech was uncertainty. It is still uncertain. I think not so much in terms of how we're learning to live with COVID and the impact it has on the economy. I think we now have a much better idea of that, and we can see that in the data. But now the uncertainty is sort of transferred to inflation and to wages and what's happening there. And that's where the RBA are now focusing their attention. We've got a lot of focus on how well the economy is doing, the strength of the labour market. That's all very positive. And that is partly what's fueling markets in their view that rates are going to go up. But at the same time, the governor was very quick to flag that the inflationary pressures, they could turn out to be more transitory than the markets are expecting. Some of them will ease naturally. Fuel prices, for example, won't keep going up at the same pace they have. But others, we could see a bit more of a resolution, particularly around supply chain disruptions and the disjoint or disconnect between supply and demand. And that could mean that things ease. So it's uncertain. And I think that's really what he was trying to stress in his speech, that the RBA, they're going to be patient and cautious. But I do think 3 or 4 rate hikes this year is a bit premature from the markets. I don't think we're going there yet.
What has changed, though, and I think you and I were talking about this last year, is that the RBA was insisting that rates would stay on hold until 2024. That is now clearly, they're not saying that anymore, put it that way.
No, absolutely. And I think that it is definitely true that the RBA, indeed all economists, have reassessed what's going on with the economy. And it is a much more positive story than we were all expecting a year, certainly at the start of the pandemic, nearly 2 years ago now. We've had switching in spending rather than just a contraction in spending. We've had the fiscal supports, which have been incredibly effective. Business investment is running very strong. We've got data just today, in fact, confirming that capital goods imports, so that investment trend is still very much there. And we've also got all of the direct government spending coming through as well on infrastructure, maintenance, healthcare, education, all of those budget announcements, they're now sort of hitting the road. So there's a lot that's positive on that demand picture, and that's the real difference, and that's really what's shifted the RBA's view.
The key here, of course, is inflation, currently sitting at 3.5%. The underlying rate's 2.6%. Actually, Sarah, can I get you to explain what that underlying rate is and how the RBA gets it? Because that's the number it really cares about.
Yes, exactly. And as you noted, there's quite a bit of a difference between that underlying rate and that headline rate. The RBA really cares about the parts of inflation that are influenced by domestic conditions and how the labour market is playing out, what's happening with wages. And so what you get coming through the headline rate quite often is volatility that's really beyond their control. A great example at the moment is what's happening to fuel prices globally. They've been tracking up recently and very, very strongly. And that's really because of what's happening in terms of global supply and demand for oil. We can't do much about that. So that strength in fuel prices is not something the RBA would ever respond to, because raising interest rates or cutting interest rates doesn't really do very much. So what you do then, and what the RBA does, is they strip out those volatile components that sit just right at the end of the distribution of the pace of inflation across goods and services. And they just look at the middle bit. And the middle bit does tend to be the stuff that's very influenced by what's happening domestically. And so that's why they focus there. It's running a little bit cooler than headline inflation at the moment, but it's in the top half of the target band. So it's very much stronger than it was just a few months ago. And that's a key metric for them when they're thinking about setting interest rates.
So that the RBA is predicting wages growth to 3% next year, when they're predicting that unemployment will be down to 3.75%. There is, of course, a bit of inertia in our system because a lot of people are on multi-year enterprise agreements and there's still wage caps in the public service. So it won't get going immediately.
That's right, absolutely. The wage dynamics are really interesting. What you tend to find is that when you get a tightening in the labour market, the first part of the economy that really starts to feel that in terms of upward pressure on wages is the private sector. So those people that aren't subject to or less subject to those agreements that you mentioned. So if you work for a private company, you might be able to right now bargain for a pay rise, or you might be able to look for a job and find a job that pays more. And so that's the first sort of signs of pressures in terms of the labour market. And in fact, we've already starting to see that a little bit in the data, and we'll get the December quarter in a couple of weeks. It'll be interesting to see how much more of that comes through. Then it takes time to filter through those to the other parts of the economy, particularly the public sector and those people that are subject to those collective agreements. And so for the public sector, what we're looking at is the unwinding of those pay freezes. That has started, but has further to run. And for those on collective agreements, they tend to be anchored to the underlying rate of inflation in the economy. And then obviously on top of that, in terms of a real pay rise, again, it just takes time. So if your agreement's not going to be renegotiated for another 6, 12, 18 months, whenever it is, then obviously you won't see your wages move until that point in time. So there is stickiness there. And that's also something the governor really wanted to highlight and flag. And part of his sort of cautious, patient, wait and see approach is related to that dynamic.
Patient was the watchword, I think, Sarah. Thank you very much for joining us today on The Money.
Thank you.
Sarah Hunter from KPMG. And I'm Richard Ailey. This is The Money. Philip Lowe isn't the only one giving speeches. The day before, it was the Prime Minister.
In coming months, two bonus payments of up to $400 each will be paid to aged care workers, including those providing direct care, food or cleaning services.
Scott Morrison promising extra payments for aged care workers. I'm sure you heard about it. But is it really enough to address the critical shortage of staff in the sector? Stephen Ducker is the director of the Health and Aged Care Program at the Grattan Institute.
It's a derisory amount, Richard, and doesn't address the fundamental problem. Basically, the Royal Commission into aged care quality and safety identified that there are serious problems in the aged care industry, difficult to get good staff, and the reality is that staff in aged care are paid less than other parts of the health system, and more importantly, they're often paid less than a burger flipper or a person in retail. And so the jobs in aged care are really complex. We want really good people, really dedicated people, and we're just not paying them enough. So basically the unions have said we need to have a work value case to check and to assess what the fair price is for a worker in aged care. And they put in a case for a 25% pay rise. Now, of course, that's just what the unions have asked for. It's not what the Fair Work Commission has determined. And they're now working with employers to see if they can get an agreement with the employers about what the facts are. And they're making some progress. They've just lodged some documents in the last couple of weeks. But basically everybody, employers and unions alike, agree there has to be a lift in wages.
We'll get to this Fair Work Commission thing a bit later, Stephen. But I have to say, when I looked at this after the Prime Minister's speech, I was a bit staggered. My 18-year-old daughter, about to go to uni, is earning more in a shop with very little training than people like personal care workers in aged care.
So, Richard, we looked at this. We looked at a number of awards, and what your daughter's experience is absolutely right. The relativities are all stuffed up. The responsibility in a retail is nowhere near the responsibility in aged care, and we're not actually, on any reasonable sense, paying what these people are worth. Mm.
$22 an hour is where it starts for personal care workers. There's been numerous reports on this, Stephen. It's a very well-established case, and I don't think it's a coincidence that the workforce in aged care is 80% women and about a fifth are from different linguistic backgrounds.
It's also that the education levels are low. We don't have any requirement for people to have even a certificate from the vocational education system. So it's got all the characteristics of basically people who are being ignored because of they're women, because they're from culturally and linguistically diverse backgrounds, because they've got lower levels of education.
How much is this down to the model, the way this is funded by the government?
So there are lots of areas where the government is the main funder. Basically all of healthcare, 70% of all the money in the healthcare industry comes from government. But in the case of aged care, it's a bit higher than that. And so the employers are saying, we can't actually negotiate increased pay unless the government steps up and says, we will actually pay what is a fair and reasonable wage so you can afford to pay the workers.
Mm. At the moment, there is very high levels of casualisation, very poor levels of job security.
Richard, this is another problem with the industry, quite separate from the wage problem. And what we saw in COVID is many, many workers are working in more than one site. They get COVID in one site and take it to the next. And so the workforce is further disempowered and we have further problems of quality of care because of the casualisation, because of the low numbers of hours people are working per person. There's no continuity with the residents and so on.
There was a workforce strategy document in 2018. The case has been before the Fair Work Commission since, I think, the end of 2020. What should the government be doing?
At the moment, the employers and the unions are actually working quite well together. But both sides have said we need the funder, the government, in the room at the same time. And the government has said, no, we don't want to have any part of this. We'll just post you a letter which says, here's some information. They're not actually serious about addressing the fundamental problem.
It seems clear that there's only going to be an increasing need for aged care workers the way we're going.
That's right. Both in terms of home care especially, but also in terms of residential care. Even though the proportion of older people in residential care has been going down for the last decade, there's a lot more older people around, and so we're going to be needing more aged care services in the future than we have in the past.
I'm wondering if it says something about us that there have been complaints, families have complained, but we've basically been content as a society to do it this way, even though we know it's not being done well enough.
So I think that's one of the great things the Royal Commission did. It just lifted the lid and said to Australians, this is the aged care system you're currently paying for. Do you think that's good enough? And basically everybody was horrified. And they said, wow, something needs to be done. The outpouring of support for actually addressing the fundamental problems was pretty dramatic. And it's obviously something government has to do. And so far the Commonwealth Government is put its head in the sand.
Mm. Now, I understand there is a law change coming, Stephen. What opportunities does that present here?
Well, there are a couple of things that are being planned and developed at the moment. The first is the Aged Care Act that currently regulates all of this is about 30 years old, and it needs a total rewrite. In fact, it needs to be thrown out and start again. But the fundamental issue in the Aged Care Act, it needs to be based on the rights of older Australians. At the moment, it's written with this Stalinist ideology about controlling spending and limiting the number of services and so on and how many services are allocated. And that ideology is totally wrong and we need to throw it out and start again. There's another thing that's happening, and that's a payment model change. And that actually, I think, will provide an opportunity for further reform.
How might we change the model to make it better?
So what the new payment model does is it revises the categories that are used for paying owners of residential aged care, and it introduces an independent body which will set the relativities and set the prices. And the virtue of that is if there is a wage rise, it will flow through the system and then automatically will affect what is paid to the owners of residential aged care. The only problem is there's a couple of years gap between when the owners have to start paying and when it flows through automatically. And that's the thing that the owners are really worried about.
Stephen, you're an expert in this area. You've been in and around it for decades. Are you optimistic that we're going to get this right?
Richard, unfortunately, I'm not optimistic. For the government to stand up and say, oh, we think the answer is to give away $800 once off, just shows they do not understand the fundamental problem. A once-off $800 or $400 once and $400 again is not doing anything systematic. It's not addressing any of the problems. It's not addressing what the unions want, what the owners want, and what the Royal Commission wants. And so it just shows they really don't understand.
Stephen Duckett from the Grattan Institute. This is The Money on RN and wherever you get your podcasts.
If the worst happens and the destructive firepower of the Russian army were to engulf Ukraine's towns and cities, I shudder to contemplate the tragedy that would ensue.
Yeah, yeah.
And the bloodshed comparable to the first war in Chechnya or Bosnia.
British Prime Minister Boris Johnson avoiding talking about illegal Downing Street parties by talking about Ukraine. As of now, tens of thousands of Russian troops are deployed near Ukraine's borders. Russia denies that it will invade, and America threatens that if it does, the US will unleash massive economic sanctions. But to what end? Nicholas Milder is Assistant Professor of History at Cornell University and author of Economic Weapon, The Rise of Sanctions as a Tool of Modern War. He joins me now. No war yet, Nick. Is the threat of sanctions part of what's holding the line?
At the moment, I think it's difficult to say because there isn't yet real clarity about which sanctions would be imposed if Russia were to escalate, and also what exactly would count as an escalation. We've been for a few years now already in the situation that some people have called gray zone warfare, and sanctions themselves, in a way, are also difficult to classify because light sanctions are clearly not very invasive, but heavy sanctions do actually get close to being acts of war in certain situations. So it's kind of uncertain is the short answer.
Well, I think Congress the other day, or certainly a member of Congress the other day, was talking about the mother of all sanctions, and the Biden administration has been threatening to use them since December when this began. How able would Russia be to deal with a suite of sanctions?
So we'll have to see what will happen when sanctions and if sanctions get imposed. In the end, we can't really say precisely beforehand, but it would appear that sanctions at the moment would have less effect than they had previously. Russia has been better prepared at the moment than it was 8 years ago when the first Western sanctions were imposed. It's done a number of things in the meantime. It's built up very large foreign exchange reserves. It's created a domestic alternative payment system for use within the country. It's also moved its agricultural and food production onto a more self-sufficient footing. And it's taken a number of other measures to make sure that it has to rely less on issuing international debt. And all of those things, I think, put together mean that the Russian economy right now is more resilient against sanctions than it was 8 years ago. And it's also the sanctions that have been in effect in the last 8 years that have contributed to that, because Russian policymakers have effectively been able to use those sanctions as a kind of stress test for the bits of their financial system and the bits of their economy that they're trying to insulate against sanctions.
Well, get in a moment to really the meat of the book you've written, which is kind of how we got here and the rise of sanctions. But they are now, or they have been for a while, part of the international relations toolkit for countries like the US and also the EU. How effective are they more generally these days?
On the whole, I think you can see that sanctions have, as they have been used more and more, actually gotten less effective at changing the behavior of their targets. And it's definitely true that sanctions, when you impose them particularly on weaker and smaller countries, countries that are less economically developed, have really significant economic effects. I think you can see this right now in Afghanistan, for example, where after the withdrawal of Western troops in August, almost without a debate, really almost reflexively and impulsively, the United States government chose to freeze the assets of the Afghan government. But it's one thing to impose severe economic costs. Those effects, I think, are undeniable. But it's quite another to actually translate that sort of economic effect into political efficacy, into achieving the political goals that you want to reach. That's much harder, and at that, sanctions have proven much less effective.
Just while I think of it, Nick, because I'm of the right age for this, were sanctions not effective in the 1980s in putting pressure on South Africa's apartheid regime?
Yes, sanctions were a very important part of the campaign against apartheid South Africa, and it definitely had some effect. However, in that case, there were some other factors that also played a role, particularly in the timing of when the apartheid regime chose to surrender. Historians who've looked into this now also think that a large part of the answer was the fact that the Cold War ended, and that made it possible for de Klerk, particularly, to make these overtures and dismantle the regime and move forward into multiracial democracy without having as big a cost attached to it and this fear of communism, which was there during the Cold War. And the other thing to remember is, about South Africa, is that it was actually put under sanctions already by many countries going back to the 1940s or 50s. So they definitely played a role, but it was a very long-winded affair.
Not a quick fix. Nick, obviously you're a historian, and your book, Economic Weapon, The Rise of Sanctions as a Tool of Modern War, really unpacks it all at length. But briefly, how long have we had sanctions? When did they begin?
The origins of sanctions go back to about a century ago, and it's really the period around World War I, which is when they were created. And what that really prompted among Europeans was the sense that they needed to find a new instrument that they could use, international organizations could use, in order to prevent a repetition of a war that terrible. And what they found was that the instrument that they had used during the war, economic blockade, could actually be taken out of wartime and then reapplied in peacetime. And that's really the origin of economic sanctions. And the first organization that had that power was the League of Nations. And in the interwar period, it was really the first moment in the last 100 years and in modern history that policymakers tried to use economic pressure to prevent wars breaking out between states. So in that sense, the whole confrontation with Russia right now is really back to the original classic purpose of sanctions, which is to prevent conflict between countries.
Of course, the intention of preventing war did not stop what happened at the end of the 30s with World War II occurring. In fact, there are people who argue that part of why Japan got into the war when it did was because of the sanctions America was placing on it.
Yes, exactly. And that's an important thing that went wrong in the 1930s, because sanctions and their chances of success, history shows, really depend on the moment and the particular circumstances in economic history and in the development of the world economy. Some moments are much more propitious, much more suitable for the use of sanctions, and they're much more likely to make sanctions work than others. And in the 1930s, there had just been a major global depression, and it was the Great Depression that really weakened the power of sanctions. And the reason was that many countries, in response to the depression, turned towards economic nationalism, protectionism. They became much more inward-looking, so they were already much more inclined to distrust each other. And when you then start to threaten countries with further pressure, with further isolation, you don't actually make them restrain their behavior. You make them more aggressive. You make them likely to search for more ways of becoming independent. And that is very much what happened with Italy, fascist Italy under Mussolini, and also to some degree with Nazi Germany and with Japan. Yes.
When do we get to the point post-war, in fact, significantly post-war, I think, when the US started really using sanctions? Is that a reflection of just their inexorable rise in economic power, or is it that plus the fact that so many instruments that make this possible are kind of within their purview?
So the United States is in a very interesting country in this case, because they weren't always that enthusiastic about sanctions. And actually, during this interwar period, when the League of Nations and European countries were very much trying to use sanctions to preserve world peace, the United States really remained on the sideline. And it's only in the 1940s, as you mentioned, when they began to rise into their current really global hegemonic role, that they started to look with a new, fresh eye towards sanctions. And that was possibly also because they had a much bigger economic heft. Their currency, the US dollar, then became the global reserve currency. And as a result, there were many more levers now available to people in the American state to try and influence behavior of other countries. So during the Cold War, there was an increasing role for sanctions. But really, the moment when they exploded into their current omnipresence and their current high frequency of use was after the end of the Cold War. So the 1990s and the 2000s, that's really when the modern popularity of sanctions took root.
Now, what we have seen this century, though, is that kind of the inexorable move towards globalization has been challenged by things like the rise of nationalism, which we were talking about earlier, and more recently, of course, the pandemic. How have those things affected the usefulness of sanctions?
So those shocks are very much an interesting parallel between today and the interwar period. And I think that's what makes this history really worth studying, because we have a period to compare it with. And the 2008 financial crisis and global recession and then the recent COVID recession have made globalization and the world economy a bit more brittle. We experience this right now, right, in the supply chain crises and problems that we have, and in all sorts of other ways, the chip shortage. And sanctions in this context also are both more difficult to use because countries are less willing to endanger the interdependence that still exists, but they also actually aggravate some of these problems when you do use them. So the effect actually of, for example, American sanctions on Huawei, the Chinese telecoms communications company in 2019, was that Huawei became very scared it would be cut off from access to semiconductors. And it began in a kind of panic to buy up semiconductor components all over the world. And that's one of the contributing factors to the chip shortage that we've had now for several months.
Are there ways, Nick, I know you're not an economist, you're an historian, but are there ways of using economics or financial instruments that work in terms of getting what you want in foreign policy terms?
I definitely think that there are instruments, and some of those might also include actually more positive inducements than sanctions. One of the things that we've seen in the last few years also is the really march around the world of China's Belt and Road Initiative, and I think that that actually contains a lesson for the West in how we too can actually garner more influence in certain countries, and that's that you can more easily obtain influence when you provide resources and funding than when you withhold them and deprive countries of them. And maybe that's also something that we can do now, not just to alleviate humanitarian crises caused by sanctions like in Afghanistan, but also in the case of Ukraine. One of the real big problems for Ukraine and the thing that makes it very difficult for them to defend themselves at the moment is that they really have been suffering from at least two decades now of economic stagnation. Their income level has really not developed at all much since the 1990s, and they really lack, as a result of the threat of war, but also corruption and underinvestment, a solid domestic infrastructure base. Economic growth and incomes are very low. Ukraine's gotten a lot of military aid, and there's talk of more of that. But what it also really needs in the long run is substantial economic aid. And this is also one of the things that a famous economist like John Maynard Keynes actually proposed in the 1920s and 30s. He said, focus more on providing positive assistance to the victims of aggression and to countries in need, and less on negative punishment of the aggressor. That way you also create a more positive dynamic in the world economy, and you ultimately stimulate trade and you keep globalization more intact.
That, I think, is a good place to wrap this up. Nick, thank you very much for joining us today on The Money.
My pleasure. Thanks very much for having me on.
Nicholas Smilder is the author of Economic Weapon, The Rise of Sanctions as a Tool of Modern War. And I think we'll do a bit more on economic history. It has a bit of value. That is it for this week. The Money is produced by Kate McDonald. Our sound engineer is Jennifer Parsonage. I'm Richard Ady.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.